Revelation chapter 18. By now, you should all know what we are studying about in Revelation 18, and you shouldn't be confused by that moniker, Babylon. Chapter 17, we saw that the terminology conveyed to us that the topic was, even though spoken about as Babylon, that the topic, in fact, was about a corrupt, fallen religious system, notably that of Antichrist during the tribulation. Chapter 18 does the same thing. It gives us the terminology that conveys to us very definitely, without excuse, without question, that it is dealing with a fallen or rebellious or corrupt economic system, notably that of Antichrist during the tribulation period. Now, I admit, I spoke about that last week in a way that sort of presupposed that we all understood that, though the text really, we hadn't covered anything in the text to indicate that yet. But today that's going to become crystal clear. The rest of the passage is going to be extremely transparent about this. We are dealing with a commercial system. We're dealing with commercialism and consumerism. You're going to read words like merchants and even the word merchandise. And then when we get down so far, somewhere around verse 9 or so, I could look, but I'm too lazy. Somewhere down there, the further along we go, the Lord is in this chapter going to give us a list of that very thing, merchandise, that the Lord will destroy in this chapter. And again, we've already studied it in Revelation chapter 16 with that seventh bowl judgment. We read very briefly and concisely about the fall of Babylon, so we knew that had happened, and now it's like a rewind of the tape, a shift of camera onto a different subject, onto a specific subject, and a replay of the video so that we can see in detail exactly how Babylon falls. And interestingly enough, chapter 18 tells us, really, it's just one angel that the Lord designates for this work, the destruction of the fallen world economy, just one angel that accomplishes that. So remind me again why the world would intentionally put themselves at enmity with God. This is one angel that brings down the best economic system that the world has ever built, and one angel in a moment of time, in the blink of an eye, brings it all crashing down. And I just love it. I just love it. God is all-powerful. There's no one like him. I love those songs we sang about just a few moments ago that highlight those truths. There's no one like our God. Our God is great. Our God is awesome. And if God is for us, who can be against us? Indeed. Anyway, that should suffice as a sufficient framework for this study today. So on top of that, we should be able to make better time now as we move through this chapter. And good thing, because I didn't leave myself as much time as Tammy normally does. Amazing. I don't know how she does it. She does 5 songs minimum. Am I right, worship team? 5 songs minimum. And she's done it 10 till. I do 4 songs. And then I'll have time to preach or teach. So, but we should be able to move more quickly through this now because we know what the chapter is. We know what we're looking at. We know what we're dealing with. And we should be able to pick this up with reasonable amounts of commentary from the preacher up here. So let's begin in verse 6. In verse 6, we have a shift. You got to be careful with this chapter because in this chapter, there's a lot of different speaking to a lot of different groups going on. Verse 1, that was John speaking to us, his readers. In verses 2 and 3, that was the angel speaking, this angel highlighted and brought into focus in this chapter. But when we get to verse 4, which we did last week, we see that the Lord begins speaking, but he's going to be hopping all around. He's going to be all over the place. First of all, in verse 4, as we studied last week, the Lord was speaking to those saints that had survived the tribulation and are still on the earth at this time. Now in verse 6, he's going to address a different situation entirely. He's going to address this angel and give him specific instructions for this judgment on Babylon. And then as we move further down along through the chapter, the Lord is going to turn and address another group altogether. That would be those caught up in this economic system of Antichrist. The kings, the rulers, the merchants, and the buyers. So you have to really let the subject matter define who the Lord is speaking to at any given moment. I'll help you with that as we go. But know this, going into verse 6, the Lord begins giving instruction to this angel concerning his judgment on economic Babylon. And here's what he begins saying in verse 6. Render to her, economic Babylon, just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix double for her. Now that is showing us where the needle sits on the gauge of God's wrath. All right, because normally, first of all, as Christians, as believers, we are used to seeing the merciful side of God. Isn't that wonderful? That's the side of God that we know. We don't know the wrathful side of God. And that is because, of course, the wrath that would be directed toward us is no longer directed toward us because we believed in Christ, we came to the cross, we accepted him as our proxy, as our substitution, and as a result, that wrath that would be aimed for us because of our sins, it was poured out on Christ on the cross, and we're free to go. Now, as far as the unbeliever is concerned, the unbeliever living in a sinful state, they would be used to the judgment of God that dates back to the Old Testament days. That would be the method of judgment known as, very popularly, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. Simply put, the sinner who has not been redeemed by the blood of Christ can expect a judgment that is an exact harvest of what they have planted with their lifestyle. But when we come to this passage, this verse, and we read about this economic Babylonian system, it becomes very clear that the Lord does not handle this system in the same way that he would a sinner and a sinful person. The Lord considers this system to be not just sinful, but wicked. And there is a difference between sinful and wicked. There is a fine line there. Personally, I wouldn't want to get anywhere close to it. But there is a fine line between sinful and wicked. And go do a word search through the scriptures, and you'll find that when someone falls into that category of wickedness, God's anger burns hotter for that person or for that system than it would just a sinner who will not come to him for salvation. That is an absolute truth. Now, that does not mean that when a person tips that scale from sinfulness into outright wickedness, that God loses his cool, loses his temper, and overdoes it in judgment. Absolutely not. I think the book of Psalms, chapter 7, verse 11, puts it very well, states it very accurately for us. The psalmist David writes that God is a just judge, and here's a statement you wouldn't expect to follow that. God is a just judge, and he is angry with the wicked every day. Every day his wrath and fury kindles over the wickedness that takes place, but he's still just. Those two things do and should coexist. That God is just, and that yet in spite of that, on top of that, but perfectly in line with that, God is also exceedingly angry against the wickedness that takes place in this world. So if we read in verse 6 that God is doubling up on the judgment of this economic system, if we read that God is pouring twice as much into that cup for the judgment of this economic system, that is telling you that God views this system as corrupt to the core, as absolutely wicked, and you can rest assured that even when God does double up in judgment or exceed eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life, leveling up, squaring up, when God does exceed that style of judgment, his judgment is still perfectly righteous and well-deserved. Verse 7, in the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen. She probably even has those PJs with queen written around the backside. You know what I'm talking about? She thinks highly of herself, this economic system does. I sit as queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. She has a false impression of herself. Very similar to what we studied about in Christ's letter to the church at Laodicea in Revelation chapter 3. You remember that church? They thought they were hot and holy. They thought they were wealthy and well-to-do. What did Christ say to them? You don't know that you're, first of all, lukewarm. On top of that, you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Talk about having a false opinion of yourself. I mean, that is way out there. For a church to be that far off in self-assessment is scary, but imagine how far off in the accuracy of self-assessment that the world and the systems of the world can get when they're not even trying to use this as the standard. Oh, she thinks she's fine. The system seems stable. Everything is going well. And she feels absolutely untouchable. And anytime that happens, I would have to think the Lord takes that as a taunt. I don't need you, God. I got this under control. This system is secure. My way works. I think the Lord takes that as a taunt. Indeed, he does here. Verse 8, therefore her plagues will come in one day. In fact, multiple times in this chapter, you're going to read the words 1 hour. Not just one day, 1 hour. The point being that this economic system, Babylon, is going to go down the tubes fast. The Lord is going to bring an end to it very quickly. In one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. Now, if you take notes, you're going to want to have this passage down. Trust me. It is Isaiah chapter 47, verses 8 through 11. It is the prophecy of the fall of the actual original kingdom of Babylon, predicted by the Lord through Isaiah before it ever happened. At the time of this prophecy that I'm going to read to you, Babylon was ruling over the entire world. As we studied in Revelation, Babylon was the third world empire ruling over the world. And as Isaiah pens this at the inspiration of God and calls for the downfall of Babylon, it would be a laughable thought, because Babylon as the world empire, that seems stable, that seems secure, that did not seem that it could possibly change anytime soon. And yet Isaiah sits under the inspiration of the Spirit and pens these words, Isaiah chapter 47, verses 8 through 11. Therefore, hear this now, you who are given or addicted to pleasures, who dwell securely, who say in your heart, I am, ooh, be careful, that is the name of God. You say in your heart, I am, and there is no one else beside me. It's all about me. I got to get my own. I got to do what makes me happy. Nor shall I know the loss of children, verse 9. But these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. Okay, first of all, back up. Did you catch the word widow? Original Babylon was saying the exact same thing as end time economic Babylon. Original Babylon was saying, I am no widow. And original Babylon was told that its fall would happen in one day. Exact same wording that we read from Revelation chapter 18, verse 7. Reading on, the loss of children and widowhood, they shall come upon you in their fullness because of the multitude of your sorceries. We're going to get to that word in Revelation 18 as well. Because of the multitude of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments, for you have trusted in your wickedness. You have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you. And you have said in your heart, I am, there that is again, I am, and there is no one beside me. Therefore, evil shall come upon you. You shall not know from where it arises, and trouble shall fall upon you. You will not be able to put it off, and desolation shall come upon you suddenly, which you shall not know. In other words, you are not going to know what hit you. You think you're safe. You think all is well. Peace, peace, safety, security. And they're not going to know what hit them. Now, as you just saw, that text, Isaiah chapter 47, verses 8 through 11, is used by the Lord in Revelation 18. He refers to it heavily. He even takes direct quotes from that passage. Why? Because he is connecting these two institutions. He is connecting, for our learning, original Babylon, the kingdom, with this end time Babylonian system. Why is he doing that? Because history is going to repeat itself. More on that in a second. First, I want to stress that when this prophecy was given by Isaiah, had he mentioned this prophecy to anyone in Babylon, they would have laughed him to scorn. It was, in their thinking, impossible for Babylon to fall. And anyone with half a brain looking at it reasonably would say the same thing. That kingdom, as the world empire, is about as secure as you can be. Babylon had a massive army. Babylon was ingenious in its layout. Babylon was surrounded by walls that were absolutely impenetrable and insurmountable to troops. Apart from the front gate of Babylon, which they weren't going to let you in if you were the enemy, but apart from that front gate to the walls of Babylon, the only way to get into Babylon would be through the Euphrates River, which was channeled to run through the city walls of Babylon and into Babylon itself But even that channel where the Euphrates River passed under the walls of Babylon, they had a system of metal grates coming down from that opening all the way down deep into the water so that if you tried to pass underneath that grate, you would drown. You would absolutely drown. That grate was big enough to let water through, some fish through, but not people. To try to get through would be a very deadly thing to do. So, feeling about as secure as they could, feeling about as confident as they could, in 539 BC, the enemy shows up at the gate. It was the Medo-Persians. They had arrived there at the gate in Babylon. And here's the crazy thing. Babylon knew about it. Babylon knew that the Medo-Persian army was outside the walls of the city. And guess what they did about it? Nothing. They didn't care at all. They weren't concerned or worried a bit. You can read the story from Daniel's account in Daniel chapter 5. He tells this story. On this night in 539 BC, when the Medo-Persians came to invade Babylon, the people of Babylon, especially the rulers and the leaders of the empire, sat there in the palace and in the city square and in their homes partying, drinking wine, in fact, getting drunk, celebrating, laughing at the foolish army outside, knowing that they're fools. There's no way they're getting into our city. We might as well just party it up, live it up, and have a good time laughing at the feeble attempts of our enemies. Here's what they didn't know. They didn't know that for days in advance, the Medo-Persian army took their soldiers upstream of the Euphrates and began digging channels to divert the Euphrates water away from Babylon. And a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, they diverted more and more water away from the city of Babylon until the water level was low enough that the Medo-Persian army could pass right through on the bottom floor of the Euphrates River under the metal gridwork right into the city of Babylon. And that's exactly what they did. While Babylon was partying and living it up, entertaining themselves, feeling about as good as themselves as they could, there's the Medo-Persian army breaching the walls of Babylon, completely unbeknownst to Babylon. And what they did was they attacked the outlying areas of the city first. True story. You can go home and research, search this on the internet, the Battle of Opis, O-P-I-S. You'll see for yourself. They conquered the outlying regions completely before the people in the city center, the king, the leaders, before they even knew that the city had been breached. The battle was over pretty much without a battle. Keep in mind, this was a world power, a world empire. And in that moment, on one night, that world power shifted from Babylon to Medo-Persia. We would say today, pretty much without a shot fired. Pride was the downfall of that original city. Oh, I could speak about that with it being Pride Month, but I won't get onto that hobby horse. Where in the world did we come up with the idea that pride was a good thing? The Bible warns us over and over. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Well, Daniel chapter 5 tells us about that night of the overthrow of Babylon. This is in Daniel chapter 5, verses 25 through 28. King Nebuchadnezzar has a vision. He sees this in his drunken state, a hand, nothing attached to it, but just a hand writing on the wall, like something you could see in that show Supernatural or Fringe, right? There's a hand writing on the wall, nothing attached to it. He's about to have a heart attack. He sees the words, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. and he's flipping out. He's going through the magi, the wise men, the magicians of Babylon. No one can interpret the dream for him. Who does he finally land that can interpret the dream for him? A man in whom is the Spirit of God. And Daniel tells us in chapter 5, verses 25 through 28, and this is the inscription that was written, meeny, meeny, miny, mo. Oh, wait, that's a different story. That's a different story. Scratch that. Let me start over. Meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word, Daniel says. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. It's kaput. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting or lacking. Verse 28, Perez, because the situation has changed from the time that he had the vision until the time that Daniel interpreted the vision. When he had the vision, it was, your kingdom is going to come to an end and be given to the Medes and Persians. But by the time Daniel interprets the vision, he says, Perez means your kingdom has been divided and given, past tense, it's already done, given to the Medes and Persians. They've already conquered the city. You just don't know it yet. And then we read in verse 30, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. Folks, this was the world power, and they fell in one night to the Medo-Persians. There was a change in world leaders almost without a fight. Why? Because the Lord desired it to be so. Plain and simply, the Lord desired it to be so. And I don't care what it is that you're trusting in, if it is separate from God, it is going to serve a very short shelf life. It is going to have an expiration date. One day it is going to fail you. And if all of your hope is in that, you're in trouble, because I don't care how secure you may think it be. I don't care how well off you think your lifestyle is, how carefully you designed everything with money in the bank just in case, with methods of survival just in case. I don't care what you're trusting in. If it is rebellious, there is a way for God to get the enemy through the wall. There is a way for God to find an opening to get in and to take it down with no effort whatsoever on his part. Yes, folks, history is going to repeat itself one day, because if there's one thing that we learn from history, it's that we don't learn from history. That's another pig path and soapbox I could get on. But especially, church, especially when it comes to biblical history, because the world gets its jollies by not feeling obligated to believe the scriptures. You tell them something from history, and you say, don't do this, don't pursue that, because history is unkind to that, and they'll continue on and persist in it, because to do otherwise would cramp their lifestyle. It would go against their desires, and they've got to make themselves happy, so they pursue it, not learning from history. Why? Because they believe it'll be different this time. The difference is, it's me this time. I'm a king. I'm a queen. I'm not going to be widowed. This isn't going to collapse. This is going to work for me, because I'm me. I'm special. Well, that doesn't change the truth that if God wants to topple something, there is no defense against it. No defense whatsoever. It will happen. Psalm 127, verse 1, Solomon writes this psalm. And Solomon says, unless the Lord builds the house, whatever it is, a system, a building, a government, a religion, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchmen stay awake in vain. It's got to be the Lord. Is that what's behind your system? What's your system? What's your system all about? What's your network all about? What's your foundation? What's your house? Is it the foundations of Christ and his sure word? Are you on the right side of history? Because be careful, history very soon is going to repeat itself. Babylon, in just the same manner as it once did is going to fall again. Verse 9. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city." And again, we aren't talking about a literal city. We're talking about Babylon, the economic system. It is referred to here as a city, just as in chapter 17, the Lord also referred to Babylon, the religious system, as a city as well. You could just as well say, that great system, Antichrist economy, that mighty system, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. No, this passage was not fulfilled on September 11th, 2001. Did you ever hear that? I got to admit, on September 11th, 2001, it was quite a while ago, and I didn't know a whole lot about prophecy, and I got out this passage, and I was like, this sounds kind of familiar. I think, maybe, is it possible that this passage was fulfilled with the collapse of the World Trade Centers there, the World Trade Towers, having been attacked by the government, the Muslim terrorists? This is not the fulfillment of that passage. Again, I know there's a temptation to want to put a proper name to everything we see in the book of Revelation. But bigger picture, church, what are we studying? We're not studying the collapse of an individual nation's economy. We're talking about the collapse of all economy, all commercialism and consumerism. This does not center around America. This centers around Antichrist global economic system during the time of the tribulation. Now, verses 12 and 13 give us a partial commodity list that hits the high notes of the assets that are lost during the downfall of this economic system. You'll notice that this list only spotlights those things that are expensive, extravagant, exquisite. It's the finer things in life that are being highlighted in this partial list. But do keep in mind, you could literally write anything in here, anything material, any product, any merchandise, any item, you could write it in here and it would be just as accurate, because what is happening here is the Lord is shifting things up because something new is coming and there's preparation for what is to come. There's a shift from the old way to the new way. What you're seeing here as we read this partial list of commodities is Babylon's going out of business sale. One night only, everything must go. A new kingdom is coming. Right after this, a new kingdom is coming. And all of the old inventory, the worldly stuff, the fleshly stuff, the material stuff, it has to go to make way for something new and something better, Christ's millennial kingdom. Verse 12, merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls. Ladies, that's the jewelry. Gone. Jewelry aisles, jewelry stores, gone. Fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet. That's the fine clothing. Gone. Every kind of citron wood, that is scented wood that was used to make expensive furniture, which smelled good. That's strange to us. We don't really do that. I guess we kind of do that with our cedar chests. We buy those cedar chests, and they're a little bit more expensive, and they smell really good. I'm still not sure why we all have to have cedar chests, but we do that. It's kind of the same thing here. Scented, expensive wood that creates expensive furniture that smells good. Maybe that'd be a good idea if you have a dog that likes to get up on the furniture, just a suggestion. But at this time, it's gone. Every kind of object of ivory. Oh, Melanie, there go the Yamaha pianos. No more tickling the ivories. No, I know they're made out of plastic now, but they used to be made out of ivory. Every kind of object of most precious wood, and considering the price of construction lumber today, I'd say right about now you could put just about any item of wood in that list as an expensive item of wood, and it would certainly fit. Anything you can build with wood, houses and garages and sheds and whatever, all gone. Bronze, iron, and marble. Now, you can use those for all sorts of things, but especially in the making of commercial buildings, especially in the making of monuments and statues, which America wouldn't have a problem with that part. We're already mad at statues and memorials and tearing them down, so no problem there. But all of that gone in the end of the tribulation. Verse 13, and cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense. Oh, no, there go the essential oils. I guess they weren't so essential after all. Gone. Essential oils, gone. Get yourselves done now, ladies. Get them done now, because that's going away. Wine and oil, fine flour and wheat. That right there, that's the ingredients for a rebellious party. Wine and oil, fine flour and wheat. So you have alcohol, you have bread, you have cake. In other words, the party is over. All that stuff gone, no longer in market. Cattle and sheep, the meat market, gone. Horses and chariots, personal vehicles, if you're Amish. And military vehicles, that's the representation there. Transportation, done for. And, wow, this last part gets really weird. Here's something else that was being sold, marketed and sold in this commercial system. And the Lord has brought a collapse to it. Two things. Bodies and souls of men, mankind, not men gender specific, but mankind. Bodies and souls of mankind. Let me first talk about the bodies of mankind. That's easier. The bodies of mankind. What we're talking about here, what we're dealing with here, is slave work. Slavery that's going to take place under this system during the tribulation. This is slave labor, slavery. This is human trafficking, aka sex trafficking. These are things that are, unless you've had your head buried in the sand, you know things that are going on right now in our system. The question is, who is complicit in allowing that system to take place? Is the government complicit in allowing that system to take place? Are they really honestly trying to stop it? That's a question for another study. But what's happening right now, slave labor, slavery, and human trafficking, sex trafficking, I doubt that it's going to stop. I doubt that anyone stops it in this country. I do know that during the tribulation, it is going to be a thing. If not again, then still. It is going to be happening. The bodies of people are going to be marketed under this system for whatever those corrupt purposes, and the Lord is going to bring a stop to that. And then lastly, the really strange one, the souls of men. The souls of men being sold under this system. How's that possible? Well, it's not possible in the sense that it might sound. You can't really, truly sell your soul under a system, you know, like, I'll sell my soul to you, or I'll sell my soul to the devil if you give me so much money for this or for that. I don't really think those are bargains that you can't break. I know that when Satan hears those deals that are made with him, By the way, if you didn't know this, many people in the entertainment industry have made those deals. They're on tape saying it. They don't try to hide it. They have made those deals with the devil. They've offered their eternal soul to Satan for popularity and wealth on this earth. That's what they've done. The wonderful thing about that, as awful as that is, the wonderful thing about that is at any time, the Lord would be willing to show up and break that deal. The Lord would be willing to put his foot down and say, I don't honor that agreement. I can redeem this soul. I don't care if it was promised or guaranteed. So it's not like that. Here's what it is. We already know that during the tribulation, people will truly be selling their souls to Satan through the Antichrist, specifically through what? The mark of the beast. We've already studied that. If you take the mark of the beast during the tribulation, what you're doing is you are selling your soul to Satan in order to be a part of this economic system. So when the Lord says all of that comes down, people that have sold their souls to the system, he really means that. I'll read to you again from Revelation chapter 14, verses 9 through 11. Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out for full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they will have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. As we've well covered, that is the point of no return. That is selling your soul to the devil in order to be a part of the system, make money, and survive. Verse 14. The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. You almost kind of want to feel bad for them. Such a pitiful bunch of idiots, bunch of fools that have got themselves into this mess against all of God's obvious and clear warning. In verse 9, the kings of the earth, that would be the rulers and the leaders, they're blubbering over Babylon's fall. Boo-hoo, the system's down. In verse 11, it's the merchants that are blubbering over Babylon's fall. And there in verse 14, we just read it, who's that? That's the buyers. You got the kings, government, you got the sellers, the merchants, you got the buyers in verse 14. They're all blubbering over the collapse of Babylon. The consumers are crushed because they can no longer buy the things they're lusting for. Oh man, I had my eyes on that F-150 Lightning, that electric Ford. Oh man, only $100,000. I was so close to having the down payment, and now I can't buy it anymore. So the consumers are bummed because they can't buy the things they're lusting after. The sellers are bummed and crushed because they can't get wealthy off of the lusts of the buyers. And why is the government, why are the kings and the rulers, why are they bummed? They no longer get the taxes. Tax day is going to be real easy. I made nothing. The system went down. I made nothing. You, government, you get nothing. You know, the crazy thing is, worship team, come on up. We'll just pick up here next week. But the crazy thing is here that, yes, it's the end of the economy, but what are we studying? We're studying the end of the tribulation. In this passage, what's about to happen? They're going to see the Lord face to face and meet with eternal judgment, God's fury and wrath. They're about to see the Lord, who is indignant against this system. Their souls are about to be eternally lost. And what are they worried about? And what are they crying about? The economy. Man, it survived everything else. 20 of God's judgments have come and gone, and we made it just fine. The economy bounced back every time. The Dow shot up. The markets got healthy every time. But that 21st judgment has ruined it. And they're more concerned about the state of their bank account than they are about the state of their souls. You remember that passage I spoke to you about last week about the guy who had a bumper crop, a big year. Crops were rolling in. He had to build bigger. He had to get bigger barns, bigger storage facilities because of all the increase. You remember the Lord said to him, Fool, this night, your soul will be required of you. Well, let me read to you what else Jesus said right after that in verse 21. Jesus said, so is he, anyone, who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Be honest today. I know if I ask you what you tell me. I know we all have to have the stuff. We have to buy the stuff. We're part of the system. We don't have to love the stuff. We talked about that last week. If I were to ask you, really, where is your treasure? What's your heart soaked into? I'm sure you'd tell me, oh, Arlen, it's the Lord. It's heaven. It's the church. It's the furthering of the gospel. Your answers would be Christianly canned, I'm sure. And I'm going to ask you to answer that question in your own heart so that you don't have to give the Christian canned answer. I'm going to ask you to answer that question in your own heart today. Where is your treasure? Is it in the stuff? Is it in the system? Or is it in heaven? Is it in things eternal? Is it in things that you can and definitely will lose? Or is it in the things that no one can take away from you? The things of eternity.